Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call.
This administration today, here and now, declares unconditional war on poverty in America.
That's President Lyndon Johnson from his first State of the Union address 50 years ago today on January 8, 1964. And in launching the war on poverty, Johnson called for a comprehensive and diverse program that would address not just the pain of poverty, but its root causes.
Our chief weapons in a more pinpointed attack will be better schools and better health and better homes and better training and better job opportunities to help more Americans, especially young Americans, escape from squalor and misery and unemployment roles where other citizens help to carry them.
Within 2 years of that speech, Lyndon Johnson had pushed through a tremendous legislative agenda, and the programs that it created, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, Job Corps, Title I, Head Starts, and others, continue to shape federal policy and what we expect as a society about things from health care, job training, education, from preschool through college. But how effective have those programs been? How do we understand the path that our country has been on in the last 50 years and the fact that 46 million people continue to live below the official poverty line? And we know that's a measure that itself may not capture all the people living on what Lyndon Johnson called the outskirts of hope. If you are one of those people today, or if your life has been changed by one of those programs created in the War on Poverty, in the Great Society programs that Lyndon Johnson pushed forward, I encourage you to be part of this conversation at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Your reflections and experiences will be very important to this conversation. We're also going to be talking with three people who've done a lot of research and investigation of these questions historically and presently. First with us is Beth Mattingly. She's a research consultant at the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality, which recently released a new poverty index that shows 22% of Californians are living in poverty. She's also director of research on vulnerable families at the Carsey Institute at the University of New Hampshire. Beth Mattingly, thanks for being with us on Your Call.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us is Ann Stevens. She's a professor of economics at UC Davis and director of the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research. Ann, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks.
And finally with us is Martha Bailey. She's an associate professor of economics at the University of Michigan, and she has looked at both the short and long-term effects of what have been called the Great Society programs, and she's the co-author of a really valuable new collection called Legacies of the War on Poverty. You can find excerpts of it at our website, yourcallradio.org. Martha, thank you for the work and for being with us today.
Thank you.
So, Martha, maybe we'll start with you because you've done a real historical look at this. And maybe just because we spend a lot of time talking about poverty and inequality in the current moment, and we're going to get to that and definitely want to hear about what has changed in terms of who is poor, what the experience of being poor is in today's America versus 1964. But take us back 50 years and talk about what was the situation that Lyndon Johnson and the people in Congress who backed this legislation were responding to.
Well, they were really responding to Harrington's book and also Kennedy's tour through poor Appalachia.
Michael Harrington?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And where they really, poverty in America came to national attention and got a lot of publicity. Now, poverty wasn't really central to what Kennedy was doing in his administration. But when Kennedy was assassinated and Johnson needed to come up with a domestic agenda for his State of the Union address 6 weeks later, the war on poverty took center stage. So I'm really glad you played those clips at the beginning of the program to really set the stage.
And so talk about that's how it became a political issue, and people have talked about what Johnson's political interests were in putting this forward, as well as his own personal interests in the issue. But talk specifically, what was the shape of poverty in America in 1964? Who was poor? What were the key challenges facing people living under the poverty line then?
There are about 1 in 5 Americans were poor in the early 1960s. About 35% of the elderly in the United States. Rates for children and blacks were much higher. About 44% of blacks in the early 1960s were in poverty. So substantially higher rates than there are today.
And so those groups were hardest hits. And so let's talk about, I mean, in this book that you've recently helped edit, there, I mean, it's really amazing the scope of these war on poverty programs. I think a lot of people, when they think about the war on poverty, they may think of it as relatively narrow, and they may have some misconceptions about what it was. Why don't you talk a little bit about what people may remember or think the war on poverty was, and then what the scope of those programs was in that year and a half after Johnson made this speech?
So I'm glad you asked that question. It's a key question in our new book. So we define the war on poverty as Lyndon Johnson did in his State of the Union address and in the agenda he lays out in the Economic Report of the President in 1964. But I've been asking people working on this project what they think the war on poverty is, and one of the most frequent answers, one of the things that comes to mind, is welfare. People think a lot about welfare. But when you played those clips at the beginning of the show, it makes very clear when Johnson declared the war on poverty, his agenda was really much larger. A core idea of the war on poverty was expanding opportunities for the poor. This included things like preschool programs for poor kids. They increased funding for elementary and secondary education through the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, funding for needy college students, tuition, job training and retraining programs. The programs also included things like community health centers that are part of the Affordable Care Act today, Medicare, Medicaid, and food stamps. One of the least appreciated aspects of the War on Poverty is the Civil Rights Act and the way in which those two interacted.
Talk about that.
Well, Johnson included the Civil Rights as an equality issue, but also as an anti-poverty measure. So after years of resisting in Congress, he manages to push through the Civil Rights Act in the summer of 1964. His administration talked about poverty rates for African Americans that were around 3 times as high as they were for whites. And he saw reducing racial discrimination was not just about opening opportunities, it was also about opening exits from poverty for this group.
Yeah, that was, I thought, when looking back at Lyndon Johnson's speech, I mean, we've heard this, I mean, this phrase, people who live on the outskirts of hope, but in the address that he gave 50 years ago today, you know, he talked about some people are there on the outskirts of hope because of their poverty, some because of their color, and all too many because of both. So he was really seeing this as what he was presenting it as. This is a dual challenge that had to be taken on at the same time.
That's right. When their institutional structure is keeping people from earning their full potential, that presents a big social problem, and it was also a big problem for African Americans in that time. Their poverty rates were much higher than they were for white Americans.
Well, let's talk a little bit. So let's try to compare some from then to now. And I want to turn to either Beth Mattingly or Ann Stevens, whoever you would like to jump in at this point, to talk about that question of who is poor and what has changed in the last 50 years. We were talking about the high rate of elderly poverty in 1964 that was being taken on. That's something that's actually changed a lot, right? But have we seen a change similar in that kind of racial gap in who is poor?
Well, I think you're right to point to the elderly as the sort of clearest evidence of what can happen when we make a concentrated effort to reduce poverty rates, and we've had a fair amount of success there. When you ask what's changed, I think, unfortunately, there still is a significant racial gap in poverty rates. Poverty rates have come down for minority groups, but they're still typically higher than for majority groups. And so that continues to be troubling, but there has been some progress there.
I'd like to, this is Beth Mattingly,
yeah,
jump in on the elderly poverty rate, because I think official poverty rates are a little bit deceptive, because the large driver of declines in elderly poverty are programs like Social Security and Medicare. However, for kids, the programs that are some of the biggest drivers of poverty alleviation aren't included in the official poverty measure. So when you look at the supplemental poverty measure in recent years that accounts for the programs that are accessible to children and also considers the large out-of-pocket medical costs that elderly still face, we see much less of a discrepancy between the elderly poverty rate and the child poverty rate. The elderly poverty rate comes up much more under that type of a measure than does the child poverty rate.
Well, Beth, in 1964 and now, the question of how you actually measure poverty has been, that's something a lot of people have disagreed about. I can think on one side, people saying, hey, you know, there are people who are, because of particular circumstances, depending on where they live, what their economic opportunities are, you may have some number that says this is the poverty line. They may be above it, but they still may be living in, you know, they may be on the outskirts of hope, not having opportunity. And then on the other side, people say, well, you know, we have actually created this safety net that gives people a lot of support that really ought to be counted when we're saying what is people's effective income.
So I want to jump in here
to
a few big picture things.
Please.
Elderly poverty in the 1960s was about 35%, and it fell to about half that by 1973, within the first decade that the poverty rate that the war on poverty has been operating. So poverty rates among the elderly were twice as high as other adults in 1964, but today the situation is reversed, with elderly rate about two-thirds as high as for non-elderly adults. That's really the big picture here, and those types of changes aren't affected much by the way in which
we do the measurement.
Poverty.
And so what worked there? What was most important to making that decline possible?
I think there are two big things. Kathleen McGarry has an excellent chapter on this in the book. And Beth is right. This is the big picture here is about Medicare and the expansion of Social Security benefits.
Go ahead.
No, she's right that the big picture here is about Social Security benefits and the expansion of Medicare. So Social Security benefits increased by about 100% over the from the 1970s. Forward, and Medicare has expanded, Medicare keeps people from the elderly from falling into poverty. One thing to remember is before, and so in the early 1960s, how were the elderly going to get medical care if they retired? So they had to stay employed to keep their health insurance, but if they fell too ill to work or their spouse passed away, so this is especially relevant for women, they lost that health insurance. So Medicare keeps a lot of families from falling, especially the elderly, of falling into poverty. It also relieves the financial burdens on American families, their adult children of the elderly, who would have to pay for their aging parents' care and also provide care in the home.
So I think Medicare is in this incredible decline in the poverty among the elderly. It seems like one of the great successes of the war on poverty, and one that I think a lot of people at least are aware of in their own lives. People may not remember what it was like to be an old person in 1954 and try to take on those expenses without Medicare, but I think people are pretty aware of that program. If you all were going to point to one or two other really successful elements of the war on poverty as Lyndon Johnson helped begin it in 1964, what would you point to?
I think I would highlight a program that has actually been under attack in recent years, and those are programs that do something very simple, which is to help assist with nutritional needs for low-income people. So the food stamp program, one of the things that's coming out in this discussion is that we haven't done a great job of tracking and advertising the successes we have had in this war, and so we know from research that providing food stamps can improve infant health, infant birth weight, can help with school achievement, and can have long-term effects and make adults healthier and more self-sufficient. But because there's no way to easily track those benefits, they don't show up in official statistics, we see the food stamp program, for example, being cut more and more. And so I think those are programs that I think we just need to do a little bit more PR and point to the successes that we know have occurred.
And Beth Mattingly, what would you add? Excuse me, go ahead.
Okay. More recently, I would add the EITC, and of course, this is limited to families with at least one worker.
The earned income tax credit.
The earned income tax credit does a good job of supporting the wages of low-income workers and lifts effectively a lot of people above the poverty line and is particularly effective for families with young children.
This is your call, and we are talking about the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty. Lyndon Johnson, 50 years ago today, gave his State of the Union address where he declared unconditional war on poverty. We're talking about the many programs that came out of that initiative in 1964, many of which are still with us. And we're talking with a great panel of folks who have studied these issues. You were just hearing from Beth Mattingly. She's a research consultant at the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality. Also with us, Ann Stevens, professor of economics at UC Davis and director of their Center for Poverty Research, as well as Martha Bailey, who's an associate professor of economics at the University of Michigan, who is one of the co-editors of the new book, Legacies of the War on Poverty. And we want to invite you to be part of this discussion. We've been talking about the declines in poverty among certain parts of the population, talking about the successes of those programs, but also we know there's been a lot of shortcomings. And if you are someone who's living in poverty now, if you are someone who remembers what it was like to be poor growing up before these Great Society programs, before the War on Poverty, what do you think? What do you think has worked? What do you think is important? And if we want to expand opportunity, knowing that still 46 million people are below the official poverty line, what would you encourage policymakers, President Obama about to make his State of the Union address, what should he be addressing? 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Is it harder to be poor in today's economy? And what changes in our society have changed the experience of poverty and what it takes to get out of it? The number again, 866-798-8255. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to return to the kind of the conversation to kind of bring us more up to date. I mean, you were talking about the earned income tax credit, Beth. Now, that's something obviously not something from the Johnson administration, but something from the Clinton administration. And maybe Martha Bailey, I'll bring you back in to kind of talk about, so what's the arc of change been in terms of these programs over time and kind of that broader idea of the war on poverty? What are the big shifts that have happened over the 50 years that we're looking back on right now?
In terms of the policy?
Yes.
Well, there's a lot of things that have changed. There's the welfare rights movement that takes hold in the late 1960s, and that shifts a lot of the discussion from what I think Johnson thought was a dual-pronged approach of, one, increasing opportunities and also assuring a decent living standard, much more towards assuring a decent living standard. And that's where a lot of the political discussion has gone. But before we move on to that, can I just circle back to one more victory? Well, there's two I would really point to. I think it's really easy, and I like it that Anne made this point, thinking about the fact that the war on poverty really does a good job of increasing opportunities for two groups, children and racial minorities. So this is an era that's really pioneering some of the early childhood programs that are now so in vogue. Head Start increases educational attainment, improves health. We know that food stamps programs don't just increase food security in the short term, but they improve health over the long term, and as Anne said, make poor children much more self-sufficient over their lifetimes. The other thing to think about here are synergies. These programs don't operate in isolation. I think it's tempting to think about these programs in silos, but that's not the way to think about the war on poverty. You can think about hospital and school integration, which occurred as civil rights, Johnson really makes civil rights an important war on poverty issue, was aided by Medicare dollars because hospitals and schools, and also funds for the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, because hospitals and schools didn't get those dollars unless they were in compliance with the Civil Rights Act. And better infant health, child nutrition make public school dollars much more effective because it's hard to teach kids if they haven't had breakfast. And finally, if kids are getting a lot more education in school, we know that this increases the returns to college attendance and makes financial aid for needy college students much more effective. So these things all work together. I know it's tempting to think about the safety net and sort of human capital programs in isolation, but they actually work very synergistically.
Right, I think that, and when maybe you could talk a little bit about, I mean, there was also one element of this, and I think that, that gets forgotten, is the whole, the community action programs.
That's right.
And let's talk about that, because I think that's something, well, that's something that isn't continuing today, and in some ways was the basis for...
Well, it is in existence, you know.
In what form? Well, tell us about what
there's
it has been, what it is.
Still community action agencies. You
okay.
can look
right.
them up.
Okay, okay, well, I stand corrected.
Well, I know. I didn't know that until recently either.
Okay.
So the Community Action Program was funded under the original Economic Opportunity Act, and the idea behind this program is to not have a top-down federal government program to tell communities what they need to combat poverty. On the contrary, the idea was to make federal funds available to all groups in the country, and they could be any types of groups, local organizations, schools. They didn't have to be government-based, and the federal government made funds available through the Community Action Program for those organizations to develop customized anti-poverty programs for their communities.
Well, I want to bring in some of the folks who have joined us on the line here on your call. The number to call if you want to join the conversation is 866-798-TALK, and that is where George and Oakland called in. George, welcome to the program.
Hi. This is, of course, a timely subject, and I've spent the last 4 years studying the effect of poverty on health. We know that poverty is about lost opportunity, but one of the lost opportunities that poverty researchers have experienced is showing the links between poverty and health. So we have this vicious cycle of poverty leading to poor health, leading to poor access, leading to worse health. And, you know, we showed, for example, that the Civil Rights Act, which, you know, moved huge numbers of black women into clerical jobs, actually resulted in them having gains in life expectancy far beyond white women. So I think this is an area, again, it's consistent with this notion that everything's connected, but I think we could get some additional leverage on the issue of poverty by showing that poverty costs not just the poor, but society as well.
Yeah, I think that question of how we talk about this is an issue that is a societal-wide issue. I know, Beth Mattingly, you've certainly done work in this area. How would you respond to George's comment?
I think he's right on. I think there is literature showing particularly the long-term consequences of childhood poverty on health and later health outcomes. And so I think we understand it to a certain extent, and thinking about those costs is also quite a wise idea, not only in terms of health, but in terms of people who aren't able to participate in the labor force because of disabling conditions related to poverty, and, you know, lost wages and other outcomes that criminal activity that can be associated with poverty, and all of these costs that poverty has. But oftentimes they're not immediate. They're not an immediate effect of poverty today, but we see the effect years later of poverty from the past and pay those costs for quite a long time.
Right. I'd like to add to that. I think one of the most exciting new areas of research on poverty is that not just social scientists, but biological scientists, psychologists, are starting to understand much better what the experience, especially of early chronic poverty, does. And we now understand, for example, that may have effects on brain development, on the endocrine system, on people's ability to focus, respond to stress, and then return to an attentive, focused state. And so that sort of research is helping us understand exactly these points that are being made, that there are long-term costs of just letting people remain in poverty, that it can affect their eventual ability to function in the labor market, be productive, contribute to economic growth. And I think we know a lot more about that today, certainly than we did in 1965, and we need to sort of use that knowledge as we continue to evolve and develop new programs.
And Martha Bailey, that was part of the case that Lyndon Johnson made in arguing for the war on poverty. It was the long-term costs of not addressing these issues.
That's right. That's absolutely right. I mean, there's so... One of the exciting things coming out of a lot of social science research is that, you know, we have to wait decades to study long-term effects, right? So we can't really measure today what the effects of our current programs are. We've got to wait a while to see how they play out over people's lifetimes. One of the things about the war on poverty is it's taken us decades to see a lot of the effects on long-term improvements. And I'll come back to this idea of civil rights again. There's strong research that showed that desegregation reduced infant mortality on African Americans, and this for African Americans. And as these children grew up, improvements in childhood health translated into better achievement test scores well into the 1980s.
Martha, thank you so much. Hold that thought. We're going to come right back. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. And on the 50th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson declaring the war on poverty, we're talking about where it stands now and how we look forward. Be back right after this.
This is Your Call on KALW. We invite you to weigh in today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. If you'd rather join the conversation by writing, please send the email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also simply post a message at yourcallradio.org as well.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On tomorrow's program, I'm going to be hosting a conversation about the Common Core National Education Curriculum. We're halfway through the first year of it in implementation. I'm going to be talking about how it's working. And on Friday, it's our weekly media roundtable where we talk with journalists about coverage of the week's news. On today's show, we are asking, why are so many people still poor in America? And we're marking the 50th anniversary of the war on poverty as declared by Lyndon Johnson 50 years ago in his initial State of the Union address, and asking what has worked in that war, what we have learned from it, and what has not worked. We've got a great panel with us, Beth Mattingly, researcher with the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality, Ann Stevens, professor of economics and director of the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research, and Martha Bailey, who's an associate professor of economics at the University of Michigan. She's the co-editor of a new book called Legacies of the War on Poverty. We also have a number of folks who are on the line, and I want to go to them since we were just talking about the effects that these programs have over the long term, especially when they're directed toward helping poor children. I want to go to Deb, who's called in from Oakland. Deb, welcome to the program.
Hello, Matt, and thank you for bringing this topic up for discussion. And yeah, I mean, my personal story is that I was born right before the war on poverty, and then a decade later, my mom divorced my dad and became a single mom, and we then used food stamps, which I found quite humiliating to use at the grocery store. And we lived in subsidized housing, and it was a tough childhood. I was, you know, we were pretty poor. But, you know, 50 years later, I'm now solidly in middle class and as a nonprofit professional. And, you know, I greatly credit those programs for, you know, making one generation that was poor and moving the next generation into the middle class. And I just also, besides my personal story, wanted to step back for a second and put this in a broader context, looking at and really kind of examining how corporations, particularly big ones that are in retail, such as Walmart, their profits, their astronomical profits, can be directly linked to the low wages that they pay that really are still, you know, keeping people poor as they're working really hard. So I think we have to incorporate that kind of analysis around the corporate accountability, too, and the role that they play in keeping people poor today.
Deb, that's really a couple of really great points. Thank you so much for calling in with your story and also with that analysis. I mean, I guess when there's so much discussion right now of the question of inequality and opportunities for people at the low wage end of the economy, I mean, is there some way in which these programs kind of subsidize that low wage economy that isn't really giving people a living wage? I don't know. Any of you want to jump in there, Martha or Beth?
This is Ann. I'd love to respond. I've been wanting to talk about labor markets. And so, you know, this issue of low wages is really critical. And this is we've talked about how the policies have evolved since the war on poverty began. But what's also happened is that sort of the background against which we apply these policies has changed dramatically. And what I mean by that is that the low end of our labor markets, starting in the late 1970s, have really deteriorated. And so we have policies like the Earned Income Tax Credit, a reformed welfare system that really insists upon work or work training. But at the same time we were moving in that direction towards focusing on work, the earnings that those at the bottom of the labor market can get have continued to decline. So, you know, earnings have fallen at the bottom by about 15% over the course of the 70s and 80s, rebounded only a little in the 1990s. Our minimum wage is about three quarters in real terms of what it was in 1968. And so I think, you know, it's easy. Lots of people focus on large firms like Walmart. But the fact is that kind of across the board, if you're earning below the median wage in the U.S., you haven't had a great few decades. And that's something that we have to sort of think about as we try to evaluate how successful these programs are.
And I guess I want to pick up on something else that Deb said. She was just talking about her, I mean, that's really important to talk about what those broader changes are in the economy and what that's meant for the context in which these programs are trying to make change. I guess the thing that I picked up on what Deb talked about was that sense of humiliation when her mother and her family were using food stamps. And I think that question of, and I think this has been part of the broader discourse, is this idea that these programs aren't empowering to people, that they make people feel like they're getting a handout, and that's how they're viewed by other people. You know, you all think about this stuff all the time. How would you respond to that kind of popular discussion about this, and have there been changes in the programs to try to make that different?
I would again point to, there is some evidence that speaks to this. I think this issue of the stigma we attach to receiving assistance in the U.S. is really, I think very often in these discussions, it's kind of the white elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about. We do have this idea that it's somehow embarrassing or shameful to receive assistance. We have some great new research on the Earned Income Tax Credit, where if you talk to people who are benefiting from that program, one thing they say is that it's so empowering to know that they're receiving this assistance because they're working, and that they feel much better about that than, than just receiving a check. The challenge is that in order for the Earned Income Tax Credit to work, there has to be a job for them to go to and work and earn wages that we can then subsidize through that tax credit.
There's also research, particularly in rural America, that talks about this issue of programs tied to either working or having been a worker being less stigmatized than other programs that are perceived as a handout. And I think so that's the type of program, but also above and beyond that, the nature of delivery. The Earned Income Tax Credit is administered through the tax system, and most people file taxes, so there's not the stigma of going to a certain office to get that benefit. And I think there have been some changes. You know, the EBT cards are less stigmatizing than debit cards. I'm sorry, than foods, the traditional old school food stamps. But in some places where everyone knows everyone's business, it's still stigmatizing, and people still feel embarrassed to use that type of a benefit.
I want to bring in another caller into the conversation. Max in Berkeley, welcome to your call.
Thank you for an excellent program as usual, and thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of questions. First of all, what in President Johnson's upbringing, education, experience explain his vigorous backing of that program? That's number one. And number two, the perception is widespread that the program, to some extent, to a great extent, was derailed by the war in Vietnam politically and financially. I'll stop here and I'll take your answer of the air.
Great question. Martha Bailey, you want to take that on?
That's hard. You know, Caro's biographies of Johnson really, I think, delve into this. What could possibly have motivated this man? And it's a difficult question to answer. One little anecdote that stands out in my mind, when Johnson is talking about, I think this is in one of his speeches that he gave in early 1964, but actually I can't remember exactly where I read this. When he's talking about the war on poverty and discrimination, he talks about his experience as a young man as a school teacher teaching Mexican children and how he could see poverty in their face, the discouragement, the outskirts of hope that he talks about in that speech. And that's something he talks about, too, that he understands, or he's trying to understand as a white man in the 60s what it is like to not have the same opportunities. And he talks about what it's like to think about people disliking you for something that has nothing to do with who you are, but simply the color of your skin. So I think there are really two competing explanations for why Johnson embraced the war on poverty as his domestic agenda. One is that there's this deep humanitarian streak in him that he had suppressed for years, being this political Machiavellian to get to the top. But when he gets to the top, he really just unleashes it. There's some really interesting quotes from Johnson when he's talking about the war on poverty. He says, "Lincoln abolished slavery. We're going to eliminate poverty." So he sees it as part of his legacy. The other thing is that this was a political agenda. It's not clear that he thought this was a great issue that Americans could rally around, and that this was part of him trying to build a new democratic coalition, much like Roosevelt had tried to use the New Deal to launch, to build a new democratic coalition. After all, Johnson was a New Dealer.
So
I'm not sure what the answer is. I think there are different explanations. But what's true is that he managed to get it through in record time.
And what about Max's question about being derailed by the war in Vietnam?
I think that's part of it. Johnson has some quotes to that extent. He says that, I'll skip the expletive, of a war, he meant the one in Vietnam, cost me the only woman I ever loved. And he was talking about the war on poverty, his domestic agenda. So I think he agreed.
And but give us concretely, was it because, how did that, because it drew resources away, because it meant that they didn't build on the initiatives? What was it?
Well, I think it's all of those things. It drew resources away. It diverted political attention. It cost him an enormous amount of political capital. But that's not the only thing. There were race riots in the street, American cities burning. So Johnson was not a popular man by the end of his presidency. He ended up not running for re-election.
And I guess that, but maybe to bring this, that historical conversation about what made it possible to get these programs passed in the first place, why Johnson was committed to them. Of course, he had to have a lot of congressional support to make them happen. All of these programs passed in less than 2 years. I mean, it's just remarkable when you look back and think about it.
I don't think you should overstate the amount of political consensus at that time. Had Kennedy stayed in office, I don't think there were any prospects for passing the Civil Rights Act. Kennedy was trying to push through a tax cut that Johnson urges them to take up in his first State of the Union. That's the first item on his agenda in February 1964. So, in part, I think it's the political momentum Johnson gets because of the assassination. There's this moment in time where people are rallying around the American president, and they need a cause to fight. But the other thing that happens is that Johnson is a very effective political operator. And so even though in this first year, even before he gets this wonderfully large class, I think it's the most liberal Congress since the New Deal, in 1964 presidential election, that November, he had already pushed through many pieces of major legislation.
I want to just read a couple of emails that we've gotten, or at least parts of them. One comes in from Joseph. He says, "We still have so many poor people in America because the corporate capitalists need people to be financially exploitable and there for them to prey on. Consider alone the urban payday check cashing outlets that are purposely designed and, like other economic policies permitted by the government, so that the poor end up paying obscene interest rates and are in a cycle of default fees or loss of assets." Martin Luther King said that LBJ's war on poverty didn't even amount to a good skirmish, yet white society in every decade since slavery has claimed that, in particular, even poor black people had an unfair advantage. So that's from Joseph. Keep that in mind. And also, we got an email from Mart who says, "To take action to reduce inequality, we need a Congress that's not beholden to corporations and which puts people first." And I think this question of what the, and I think it's interesting, Barack Obama will talk about inequality, but really talking about poverty, he shies away from that. So I'm just interested what you all think about the political prospects now, what the coalition to kind of renew these efforts might be, who would be in it.
Well, this is Martha.
Yeah, Martha
Bailey speaking again. I do think since Reagan and since Johnson was so unpopular by the end of his presidency, his programs also became that. And so one of Reagan's famous quips is that the federal government fought the war on poverty and poverty won. And this has become a generalization by a lot of critics of the war on poverty that say we shouldn't even try. And more than that, we should scale back a lot of the safety net programs as aggressively as we can to stop wasting money on things that don't work. I think that's a big, it's learning the wrong lesson from 50 years of research. One of the things we know is that a lot of these programs work. The safety net has been tremendously effective. But it's true that poverty has been sort of a political boogeyman in America since I think the Reagan administration. So I do see some hope that some of Johnson's ideas of equal opportunity for all will be embraced. I was listening to a speech on YouTube by Marco Rubio. I think he's going to give the same one today in D.C. And he, the funny thing about it is he's talking about a new opportunity society. To me, it sounded a lot like Johnson's Great Society. He talked a lot about economic growth, creating better jobs. He talked a lot about gutting safety net programs as well. But he sounded a lot like Johnson when he talked about the opportunities. And one of the things this may be is an opportunity for folks on both the right and the left to come together to think about some of these core ideas. We may differ on how to get there, but I think we can agree on some of the core principles.
I want to bring in Brian in Palo Alto, who's called into the program. Welcome to your call, Brian.
Oh, hi. There's a Health and Human Services study dated October 20, 2012, and it's a study on the effectiveness of Head Start. And one of their findings is, and I quote, early effects of being in the program rapidly dissipated in elementary school with only a single impact remaining at the end of third grade. That's directly from the report. Anyone can pull it up on the website. My question is, why spend $7 billion a year on Head Start when it shows so little effect of actually changing people's lives? And my allied question is, why do the Democrats oppose school choice in the voucher program like Jindal, Governor Jindal, has implemented in Louisiana in order to give inner city kids some choice, at least some hope of getting out of the failing schools which they're now consigned to? That provides opportunity. You said that to get out of poverty, more opportunity should be provided. Surely educational opportunity should be part of that. So why do the Democrats consistently and vehemently oppose any voucher system in order to get kids out of inner city schools?
Brian, great questions. Let's get a response. Let's start. So there's two questions there, first of which has to do with the effectiveness of Head Start. How would you respond? This is interesting information.
I'd love to speak to really both, but on the Head Start issue, Head Start is a program that's gotten a lot of attention, and I will admit the results on Head Start are a bit confusing. The caller is correct that there are studies, very well done studies, that show that there's an immediate effect on kids' test scores of Head Start, but then if you follow them for a few years, those effects tend to fade. What isn't in that same study, though, is that there's also evidence that if you then look at those same kids even later, when they are adults and start entering the labor market, there's some evidence that the effects sort of come back, that they're actually doing better at finishing high school and earning in the labor market. Now, that seems like a very strange result, but, you know, there can be very strong differences in whether improved human capital, ability to learn, show up in what are often what we call low stakes test scores, where they may not have that many consequences, versus later in the labor market or higher education. And so the evidence on Head Start, there's some that's incredibly positive. There's also some reason for caution, as the caller points out. But I think I would certainly not look at the Head Start evidence and point to that as a failure. In fact, there's a lot of evidence that it is very promising. And of course, there's also huge variation across individual Head Start programs and localities, which actually ties into his second point about school choice.
Yeah, when he's talking about school choice and vouchers, let's move to that. Some people would say, hey, if you want to empower people at the local level, let them choose where to go and let the resources follow them.
Right. I would say, you know, I can't answer his direct question, which is why does the Democratic Party oppose that? That's certainly well beyond my area of expertise. But I will point to some really important research that one of our researchers here at Davis has done that shows that in examples where there have been school choice plans implemented, there are some difficulties, and in particular, many low-income areas and low-income families don't end up choosing to move their children to higher-performing schools. There's a whole host of reasons we think that might be. It might be lack of information. It might be lack of adequate transportation, safe transportation, paths to school. And so, you know, school choice is a very complicated issue, but I think it's not perhaps as simple as saying, let's just give low-income families choice and they'll get their kids to the better schools. Those schools tend to be in different parts of the city, and so there are other issues to think about there.
This is Your Call. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and we are talking on the 50th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson's Declaration of the War on Poverty, about poverty and inequality in the United States. These programs launched in the mid-60s, they stay with us in many forms today, and the continuing question of how we really address inequality and create opportunity for people who are at the wrong end of our economy. Your call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Are welcome. We've gotten a lot of great calls from people who've had the experience of living through poverty, of being affected by these programs. Also, people asking really good questions about how they're working or how they're not working. Now's the time to join the conversation before the end of the program. 866-798-8255 or feedback at yourcallradio.org. I want to read an email from David who says, the buzzword of contemporary Washington is funding. How were the various programs funded? Taxes, redistribution of the budget. I assume he's talking about the war on poverty programs that Johnson launched. And what sort of pushback did Johnson get in trying to push the legislation forward? Martha Bailey?
Well, he didn't get very much at first, but it grew over time. The funding issue is a big one, but you have to remember that in the 1960s, we weren't in the same sort of deficit situation that we are today. The economy was growing. We had a lot more money, and Johnson emphasizes that we can afford to do it, and we should. The costs of not doing it are staggering. Now, that political economy has changed today, and people are making different calculations, especially programs, the health care programs like Medicaid and Medicare. The costs have grown beyond the original architect's wildest expectations. So funding is a real issue, but there's something else to think about, too. And I think critics of the war on poverty and of a lot of these programs tend to think of these expenditures only as costs. Now, I think that that's bad accounting, because when you make an investment, you don't think about those dollars spent as a sort of a cost. You think about them in terms of the returns they bring. And one of the lessons from the war on poverty is that these types of expenditures have very large returns. Early childhood programs in particular, especially the high-quality ones, have big long-run returns.
Let's bring in John in San Francisco. Welcome, John.
Good morning. Thank you for this program. I'm 71 years old, and I have benefited by the Medicare and Social Security programs, particularly in the last year when I've had significant health problems. Without those programs, I'd probably be on the street. And there's another part of that that's very important, I think, particularly for a senior's state of mind, and that is I've paid for these programs. So I have the dignity of understanding that this is not a giveaway to me. These are programs that I pay for, and now I'm getting my money back. And both of these programs are still fully paid for and solvent. So these programs have not been a problem with our economy whatsoever, or for the problems that our government is now having in revenue. They're paid for. The other thing I'd like to bring up is the fact that we have a area that has not been well served, and that is the mentally ill. In fact, the programs for the mentally ill have been considerably cut back. These people are out on the street. They are homeless, and they're not getting the care they deserve, and they have no housing. And this is a real scandal, and I think it should be addressed. And I'd like to hear what your guests have to say on this issue.
Thank you, John.
I think that this issue of having paid for them can be looked at in different ways. I mean, we've talked about funding and thinking about these as an investment. And I think if you think about them that way and in the aggregate how they're paid back, you get a different perspective. There's also some research out of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities specifically on the earned income tax credit that shows that looks at people who've received it over time and shows that in general, looking at tax records, people do pay back, as it were, that benefit because it encourages labor force attachment, and over time they do better in the labor market and wind up paying taxes and being contributing members.
We are coming towards the end of the conversation here on Your Call, and as we think back to Lyndon Johnson's State of the Union address 50 years ago, we've got another State of the Union address coming up. President Obama has said, inequality, this is this critical challenge of our time, economic inequality. And I think, we have debates around unemployment insurance and other support programs, things that are key parts of the safety net that are drawing a lot of people's attention. I just want each of you to talk about, if you were going to talk to President Obama and say, here are one or two things that you could put in your State of the Union address that would both be powerful ways to increase opportunity and that would also would be politically powerful, that would draw people to them in the way that Lyndon Johnson's proposals in 1964 did, what would you put out there? Martha Bailey, I want to start with you.
Oh, I'm an academic. I'm not a policymaker. So,
Well, from what you know, what works? What should he champion? Say, hey, here's what we know works that we should do.
I think there's some important reasons to increase our investments in early childhood. That's a big one. I don't think that that's controversial. We know that high-quality early childhood programs work. We know that improving child nutrition not only affects their immediate health, but it has lifelong effects on education, health, and productivity. But the main thing, I think, to learn from the war on poverty is that it's important to try things. Not everything's going to work. You know, in the 1960s, they had no idea what was going to fight poverty. They had no idea how they were going to win the war, but that didn't make them afraid to try. I think because we haven't had as much success as we would have liked in fighting poverty, people have stopped talking about it. So the main thing is we need to get creative. There are no signs that growth and inequality, income inequality, should reverse anytime in the near future, so we need a lot of new ideas.
Ann Stevens, do you have some creative or new ideas you'd hand to the president?
Well, what I'd want him to do is to really focus on these overwhelming changes in our labor market over the past four decades, and to point out that let's take the victories we've achieved, which I would include in that the shift in policies towards focusing and insisting upon work whenever people are able to, and providing work support services with welfare. But so once we realize that the ability to earn a living wage has really deteriorated over time, and at the same time we've said to people, we will help you, but we want you to make a commitment to work, we have to do more to make sure that when people work, they're going to get a decent wage. And so I think that points to perhaps even further expansions in the earned income tax credit, and certainly doing something to bring the minimum wage up at least to its level that where it was in 1968, and perhaps thinking about indexing it so that we don't have to have this debate just to try to keep the minimum wage at the same level and not let it be eroded by inflation year after year.
Beth Mattingly, one idea from you before we close.
I think the one that I would emphasize, and I agree with the others as well, is access to higher education and increasing opportunities for kids and young adults to obtain a college education.
Well, Beth Mattingly, thank you so much for being with us. She's with the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality. Also with us in this hour, Ann Stevens from the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research, and Martha Bailey, co-author of a new collection called Legacies of the War on Poverty. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. Is the Common Core getting it right? On the Next Year Call, a mid-year report on the new national curriculum for public schools. Common Core's mission is to prepare more students for college and careers by focusing on math and English. But critics say it's too test-oriented and top-down. If you're a teacher or have a child in school, how has the rollout of Common Core affected you? Has federal influence over the classroom gone too far? Join the conversation on the Next Year Call.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.